Hey everybody, it's September 2nd, 2018. I'm Case Cangelosi, and this is a percussion podcast. So with me as usual are Laura Black
Hi.
and Megan Arms.
Hello.
Ben, how's it going?
Hey, doing well. How are you? How's the year getting started up?
It's fine. It's a little crazy. You know what? I do so much better when I just expect the crazy and I just hop in and I say, you know what? It's just an email day. That's all it is, and that's fine.
I always forget at the beginning of the year how rehearsals always start up, and I'll just leave it at that.
No, I just do so much better if I say like, no, it's all right. You're going in. You're not going to practice. You're not going to write anything. You're just going to email. It's fine. And then I like enjoy it. It's actually fine if I expect it. But I wanted to tell you guys, did you know that I got a phone call from a number I didn't recognize, or actually maybe it was even unlisted. And it turns out that the IRS has a warrant for my arrest.
What?
Ross,
not surprised, really.
Have you gotten this call also?
Yeah, I have.
Several of them.
Have you really? Yeah. Why aren't you in jail right now?
Oh, well, because it's technically illegal for the Internal Revenue Service to call anyone. They have to correspond with you by paper. So you'll never get a call from the IRS. You can call them. But if you're getting a call from the IRS, you know it's fake.
Wow, that was a solid answer. Yeah, that's right.
Do you feel better now, Casey?
Yeah. But it's like the most ridiculous scam. So I, of course, just hung up. But I was really tempted to, because they call you and they say the IRS has a warrant out for your arrest. You need to call this number to see what to do next. And of course, I didn't go that far, but I was tempted to. And then that person, you can follow these scams on YouTube. People have these videos where they scam the scammers and they totally prank them. And like, I don't know, it's just like such an absurd thing. Because yeah, like Ross said, dude, the IRS is not going to operate that way, obviously.
So wait, if it's illegal for them to call me, then who did I give my credit card number to?
Oh yeah, you should. Well, anyway, let me tell you guys about Ross. He is a percussionist. He's an arts administrator and an intermedia artist. He works with a variety of media and practices ranging from contemporary classical music to experimental multimedia performance incorporating video, sound, lighting, and theater. And I was just watching a piece of his today called How to Fold Boxes, and I just had such a good time watching it. He has played percussion with the International Contemporary Ensemble known as ICE. We've talked about ICE a couple times on the show. He's done that since 2011, where he is the co-artistic director. So thanks so much for joining us, Ross Carr. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So what's happening with you lately?
Just finishing up a pretty dense summer of concerts with International Contemporary Ensemble. We just finished up mostly Mozart Festival at Lincoln Center in the middle of August, where we were the contemporary music ensemble in residence, which means that we are the ones who make it mostly, because if it wasn't for us, it would just be Mozart Festival. It's kind of a joke. But the festival is a great opportunity to present new works in the for large audiences in the context of an otherwise classical music festival. Then after that, we just workshopped a giant piece in Philadelphia last weekend, where we're making a brand new piece for ensemble and pipe organ in Ben Franklin's church in Philadelphia. So that's kind of what it's like every week, a different project or a different commission or whatever. So we just keep that pace, and that's what the group is like in many ways.
Wow. Will you tell us more about the pipe piece? That sounds really cool.
Yeah. So, in, I think, 1699, a church was built in Philadelphia, and many of the founding fathers and signers of the Constitution were members, patrons of the church, including Ben Franklin. And since, I think, middle of the 18th century, it was the tallest building in the United States for 70 or 80 years, something like that. And it has a belfry filled with 13 bells that were made in the same era as the Liberty Bell, cast in the same foundry. And it also has had an organ for a few hundred years. And they just built a new one to replace the aging one. And so this really forward-thinking, radical presenter called Neighborhood House, which is an extension of the Christ Church in Philadelphia, commissioned a new piece from Nathan Davis, the percussionist and composer, and Phyllis Chen. It's sort of a co-composed piece, 13 movements long, featuring carillon in the top of the belfry, pipe organ, and an ensemble of 14 players It premieres in the Philly Fringe Festival on September 22nd. But it's been a huge, huge undertaking. We've been working on it for 2 years, and it has amplified music boxes and customized mobile organ whistles that you blow into like recorders, and a huge spatialized distribution of speakers. So it's a major technical feat, indoor and outdoor sound, and an 80-foot long music box strip that goes from the floor to the top of the belfry, so that it looks like the music box is playing the church. It's wild. Massive project.
My gosh.
I mean, you'll see lots of pictures of it.
Like a comb? So like a pitch comb?
It's like, I don't know if you've seen these music boxes that are controlled by paper strips. It's like actually more like a cardboard strip. But it's a regular music box with tines that pluck, and you can amplify it with a contact microphone or whatever. And in this case, we found these strips online that are 50 meters long. And we had the community of Philadelphia draw their melodic ideas onto the 150 of them onto this strip. And then we punched the holes, and by punching the holes, it creates the perforations that make the melody, the melodic line. And in this case, that one continuous strip goes from the ground all the way up to the belfry. And so the sound also, because of the way we have the speaker set up, gradually rises from the floor up until to the top of the belfry so that you can hear it from blocks and blocks away. It's a wild piece. And that's just one of the 13 movements. Every single one has some sort of odd, site-specific, historically influenced sound.
How is the music box diatonic? I'm just imagining people, because I know when I've used, say, with like a clinic with young students or really young kids, and we do something like, yeah, you draw something, and then it gets played back. Often, you know, they draw, like, if you drew this on a piano strip, like a wave, but it was chromatic, it might sound really weird, whereas the person's, or at least really dissonant, and the person who drew it, say the little kid who drew it, thinks like, oh, I drew like a wave, it should sound pretty, like a wave. So is it a diatonic music box, or is it chromatic?
You can choose, and we usually get the chromatic ones and then modify them, so you can remove tines to make it so it's, you know, some other scale. And Phyllis Chen is the composer of that piece, and I think mostly she's using diatonic or modal scales with the modified chromatic one. I think it's like octave and a half range, so you have some opportunity to shift it around to use different modes. And then if you can modify the tines with magnets too to make it gliss and microtonal as well. So it's a big DIY project in many ways. There's a lot of futzing around with little toys to make them sound massive in this big church.
Cool.
Wow. I'm nerding out a little bit that it's like Ben Franklin's church and that it's kind of historical to the country. It makes me wonder, are you guys partnering with some type of historical society to make this happen? You mentioned it will premiere during a festival. How exactly is all that working?
So it's really four partnerships in a way. The first is the Christchurch Preservation Trust, which is in itself a historical society, though maybe not one that feels like the Smithsonian or another super careful archivist. But instead, they have a saying where they model preservation through use. So it's still a functioning church. It has several it has an organ, a house organist, a choir director, a rector, the usual structure of a church. And then across the street from that is a building that used to be a youth space. It had a basketball court, and it's probably 150 years old or something like that. And they converted the basketball court into a black box theater, and that sort of inspired them to bring in more and more radical programming, incubating new works. And as a result of that, they built momentum and reputation as Christchurch Neighborhood House to create new works. So that's what brings contemporary music and theater and dance into the fold of this otherwise historical site. And then the third element to all of this is that the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage is a big supporter of contemporary music, dance, and theater. every year in Philadelphia. It's actually restricted to Philadelphia. So we're lucky to be able to find a Philadelphia partnership there. And then finally, the Philly Fringe Festival is just the festival that's hosting it. September, I think they go from September 8th to the 24th or something. Their website's super clear about all of that. And they're the ones who are managing the marketing and box office and stuff like that. So the whole structure is built around the invitation from the Christchurch Preservation Trust and Neighborhood House to make a new piece and celebrate this new organ. And along the way, we realized that the richness of the history of this church, especially as it relates to music, one of the first like employed musicians, employed composers in the United States was hosted here there at Christchurch. And it just brought in a lot of interesting opportunities to mix history, culture, the community, and in some cases spirituality, and not necessarily a specific type, and a sort of sociopolitics as well, because the church has a long history of progressive politics. It's quite interesting.
For our young listeners especially, would you mind just kind of defining what co-artistic director does?
Sure. So at the International Contemporary Ensemble, we are a sort of, in a way, a traditional ensemble in that we play music as a group, sometimes with a conductor. But we're also what's called a modular ensemble, which is commonly the name you'd give to a group like Talia or International Contemporary Ensemble or Alarm Will Sound, groups that play in various configurations depending on what the composer requests. So our structure, along with a lot of those groups, the musicians and the administrators have a lot of overlap. So we have an executive director who doesn't play an instrument in our ensemble, but both artistic directors, Rebecca Heller is a bassoonist and I play percussion in the group. We're both musicians as well as administrators. So the most of the decisions that I make on a day-to-day level relate to booking the concerts and deciding what gets programmed on the concerts and who we commission and how we collaborate with them and how the concerts get produced. And by produced, I mean how they end up happening, whether it's for a large audience or a small audience, or what kind of lighting and sound and sort of specifications surrounding the production. That falls to me and the team that I work with at this group. It's a group that we play about 190 concerts a year, so it's a really active and dense calendar. So we have a staff of 12 people to manage that, and 8 of those 12 people are artists in the group as well.
Perfect.
Hopefully
yeah,
that helps so to answer the question.
I think absolutely. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Ross, I'm just wondering, it sounds like your involvement as an administrator was happening from the beginning, that way you described it, but to become such a leadership role as co-artistic director, I'm just wondering how what your trajectory in the group was. Did you just start as percussionist and doing, you know, obviously a little admin as you mentioned, and did that role just grow and grow and grow? And how did you become co-artistic director?
That's a great question. So the pathway to gaining a staff role and one a leadership role in the staff at the ensemble is usually one of opting into or being proactive in the administrative decision making. Ever since I joined the group, the members have always had a structure in place that allowed people to opt into various administrative roles. Sometimes that's curatorial, meaning that's programming and piece selection. Sometimes that's production and how a concert gets made. And I just kept participating in more and more of those decisions. And organically, as the staff needs opened up, I started to fill different roles. So at first I was in charge of the media and archiving. And then that became a bigger and bigger role. And after a point, like all percussionists find themselves doing, you get put in charge of some sort of logistical element, because you already have to coordinate the percussion rental or the percussion cartage or whatever the logistics might be. So you might as well let that expand to be audio and then video and then lights. And then basically you're directing the production questions. And it's interesting because if we expand a little bit beyond International Contemporary Ensemble, the dozens probably of organizations where the percussionists have some sort of leadership role. Certainly Eighth Blackbird, and the Talia Ensemble directed by Alex Lepowski. And then Ensemble Offspring in Sydney is directed by Claire Edwards. So it's a sort of international phenomenon. The percussionists tend to take these roles on. And it makes sense logistically, of course. But artistically, I think it's nice as well, because we get more percussion playing in the ensemble context.
True. Yeah. And then so you mentioned gear rentals and things. I'm wondering how things have changed over the years that you've had this ensemble, because you're based out of New York, right, which is a very busy place. So I know you guys have rehearsal space and I'm sure instruments. Can you just talk about how that sort of evolved over time and what your situation is now?
Yeah, that's a good question. And New York is a little bit unique, and because we also have a presence in Chicago where we started. So we are actually in the same building as Third Coast Percussion and Del Niente and Eighth Blackbird. And so we often borrow their equipment and stuff like that. And like that's a perfect model for Chicago. But in New York, and what's great there is that you could load that equipment into a car and drive it to a space and park the car and use the gear and then go home. In New York, you can't do any of those things. So you usually have a rehearsal and practice studio with, for us, it's like a modest set of percussion equipment that gets us through the day. We've got the keyboard instruments and a handful of drums and Nathan Davis's beautiful oddities collection, lots of great instruments from near and far. And then things like timpani and tubular bells and really heavy, loud, large stuff, we have to rent a space to rehearse it. There are dozens of those studios in New York, and you rent them by the hour for precisely the cost of one arm. And then, you can rehearse and use the equipment that they have in their space. And then rent a different set of equipment for the gig itself, for the concert. So what we find ourselves doing is becoming, pretty familiar with the equipment in New York. We use this amazing service, New York Percussion Service, which is run by Jeff Irving and Joe Tompkins and Tom Kazumblik, and they have amazing collection of stuff. We use that all the time. So I'm starting to get to know it, and sometimes I even just like leave my own equipment in their pile so I can get it back next time. but it's a good situation in that there's people to help move the stuff. You pay them to move and cart the stuff, but it's frustrating because you can set up a beautiful set of sounds in your own studio, and then in order to get that same sound to the gig, it could be such a logistical hassle that it becomes more expensive than renting it. So we could go into the weeds on those decisions, but it's basically every concert is a cost benefit analysis of, do we use our own equipment, do we rent, and we make 190 of those decisions each year, and maybe 150 of those are on the road in another city where the decision is obvious. We don't fly with our percussion equipment, so we're renting or borrowing.
Yeah.
But we rent a space. We call it Ice House. It's in South Brooklyn in Sunset Park. It's a lofted space with about 2,000 square feet and a grand piano, and the offices are in the same structure as the rehearsal space, and it's also where I practice, so it's all kind of one spot.
That's awesome. That's cool. Well, I have the floor. I just want to say that I saw Ross this summer while I was at Interlochen, because he's from the area and he's visiting some family, and he came and gave a wonderful class to the students at Interlochen all about extended techniques, and with the goal of not actually striking anything in the class. So we were making Super Bowl mallets, and the students loved it. They were talking about it for days after. So it was really cool. So thanks for doing that.
No problem. I'm glad to hear it went well.
Well, and we actually have a Facebook question from Josh Jones, our friend Josh Jones, who's talking about that exact class. So Josh Jones says, I was very hesitant about contemporary percussion before I saw a class of yours at Interlochen. And Megan, I guess that was the most recent class, or was that back when Josh was
there? I think that was a couple years ago when Josh was there.
Okay, sure, but maybe all the same. So do you feel like an ambassador in some ways, and do you have any tips for people who may feel risk averse or have had bad feelings towards contemporary percussion?
It's a great question. I mean, I think that, I don't know, I guess part of my upbringing, and I think most percussionists' upbringing, is that you actually discover non-contemporary percussion later in life. Like, your first experiences with percussion in high school isn't Scheherazade. It's right. Certainly not playing a dance macabre on xylophone. It's playing marching band or percussion ensemble music, and that's contemporary percussion. So I think one of the distinctions that I'd like to draw more clearly is the difference between, let's say, contemporary music and the subgenres within that. So contemporary percussion, meaning stuff that's written in the last, I don't know, 50 to 100 years, versus experimental music, experimental percussion, experimental electronics, which create sounds that might be unfamiliar. You know, in the American experimental tradition, stuff started by John Cage or Pauline Oliveros or composers like that from the 30s through the 60s. I think that there is a lot to talk about there, and a much steeper learning curve to just jump into that music as a high schooler than there is jumping into the orchestral world. So I understand bridging that gap, but I also think that contemporary percussion is a big tent. And under that tent, there are composers like Steve Reich and all the composers who write for Drum Corps International and Winter Guard, all the composers who write for, let's say, percussion ensemble music at the undergraduate level. And none of that sounds like the experimental sounds that John Cage fostered in the 50s and 60s, let's say, or Pauline Oliveros in the 70s. That it's such a different sound world that I think it's important to make the distinction in my answer to say that I don't think there's any problem. I don't think there's any fear of contemporary percussion from high schoolers, because they all do it anyway. Yeah. But I do think that there's I do advocate for experimental music as much as possible, because where we expand outside of our sort of insular percussion bubble is via that music. So I didn't meet my violin playing friends via playing percussion ensemble or drum corps. I met them via playing in the orchestra or in experimental music, chamber music contexts. So I think that they're both gateways into different communities, and it's important to understand all of them. So I'm a huge advocate for my community, which is experimental music. But I have no, that doesn't mean writing off or having an antagonistic relationship with the orchestra, percussion ensemble, marching band, drum corps. I think that they're all a part of a huge complex of really interesting music. I just happen to advocate strongly for the experimental side of it.
If I could just add to your answer, and please feel free to disagree with me, of course. I've encountered professionals who, and professional percussionists who just like can't get into contemporary music. And I often want to give the answer of, I think you have to see it done really well. Like, I've had this great ongoing conversation with our buddy Ted Akatz about Corporale. And I think one of the reasons Ted says he doesn't like this piece is you don't see it done. If you see it done really well, it's just incredible. If you see it done at kind of a B minus, man, it's hard to. So I don't know. I feel like I see that a lot. And we advocate contemporary music so much, but when you see some sophomores playing Xenakis Rebons, it's I think it takes a lot to perform that, you know. I think that's a lot harder than we often hand it off to people.
Yeah, and I think that this could be a rabbit hole, but I'm happy to go down it. I think that the let's talk about sort of like our community as people who play percussion as a craft, and then let's make the distinguishing option to talk about genre and the history of lineages of various styles. So style and genre aren't things that we should necessarily embrace as being important distinctions of music, but they help to understand context. So if you are in one concert experiencing a piece by Keiko Abe, and then later in that concert experiencing Vinko Globokar's Corporale, why would those two pieces even share a concert, except to say that this is all what percussion is? And I'm not sure that that's super interesting as a programmatic question to answer. But at the same time, I think if you were to put Corporel in the context of experimental theater and experimental performing arts, performance art, it would be right at home. So in many ways, I think that I have no actual disagreement with Ted Adkatz on that criticism of Corporel. If that's alongside a rudimental snare drum solo, it's completely right. ridiculous. But at the same time, if it's performed in the right context and with the right, as you say, for certain preparation, polish, and an understanding of the concept of the piece, it comes off extremely compelling, and people leave the audience, leave the sort of concert shaken by it. It's quite compelling and can be humorous, can be very tragic. And that's a different access to an expressive capability than you get with snare drum. It's a different skill set, it's a different context, and I think we should celebrate it all. So sometimes that means withholding an opinion, let's say, until you understand fully the lineage and context from which something comes. I think that's an important thing to try to do, especially for something like Vinko Globokar or Maurizio Kagel. They're all writing performative instrumental theater works that certainly feel like percussionists have fallen into that category of performance practice, but they can be done by anyone. And neither Jesse nor Natasha are percussionists. Right. But we like to do those types of pieces, which I think is a real testament to our, I think to answer Josh's question, to our testament to our ability to advocate for something that's a little outside of the box and feel good about it and feel confident that that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, great. Ben, did you have something?
So yeah, I had sort of a follow-up question. One thing you said sort of reminded me of the thought that I've had before. When we talk about quote-unquote contemporary music, well, pretty much all percussion music other than Beethoven symphonies is contemporary music. I mean, most of our solo repertoire is written in the past 30 to 50 years, something like that. And then a lot of people don't like to make distinctions, I think, but since you went ahead and did it, I'll go ahead and do it with the distinction between, okay, well, there's sort of experimental music and sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, non-experimental music. So for example, Mark Applebaum would be considered an experimental composer, whereas Kevin Putz is a very sort of modern but non-experimental composer. And I think that in my view, especially listening to Mark Applebaum talk a lot, it seems like experimental music sort of asks questions that have been left unanswered by traditional classical music, whatever you want to call it. And I think that Mark Applebaum is someone that comes up with the answers a lot, I think, in his pieces. But I was wondering, and this might be a total dead end, but have you ever had the experience where the experimental music has actually informed the non-experimental music? Because it seems like it always goes one direction.
I think that's a great question. I think that, so I think the part of what you're talking about, of whether to make genre distinctions, style distinctions as an important feature of what we do and how we decide to make music.
And sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to say, a lot of people would say that John Cage isn't contemporary music anymore. So there is that thought.
Sure. I think that you could pick a piece from John Cage in 1944, from 1933, and from 1964, and you would not be able to tell that they were the same composer. Let's say one of his constructions, and then cartridge music, and then In the Landscape. Those three pieces, you could also say that they were by Satie and Schaeffer and by Cage, and people wouldn't probably know that that wasn't the case. So these genre distinctions are also at play within a composer, but I think more to this point of contemporary as a, I guess what I'm trying to speak to is the word contemporary as some sort of harbinger of fear and fright amongst performers, let's say from the orchestral tradition or from, I don't know, other crafts of percussion that don't access the process of working with living composers. I think there's nothing to be afraid of. There are plenty of genres that are more and more outside of conventional understanding of what music is and what it should be. And I want, my personal take is to advocate for as much of that out of the box thinking as possible, because where would Johnny Greenwood be without the instrument invented by Maurice Martineau, the own Martineau? That's experimental sound making. with voltage and radio frequencies. And now Johnny Greenwood uses that in Radiohead. So an example of what you're saying is, does it come from experimental tradition to popular conventional traditions? There's dozens of examples of that. And most of the experimentalism in recorded sound in the middle of the 20th century comes from Reconstruction era Germany in the studios and in France and Paris, in radio studios where people like Karlheinz Stockhausen were making sounds that definitely were picked up and used by a lot of popular musicians in their own experimentation with electronics. So it definitely goes both ways. And I wouldn't say either direction is actually more influential than the other necessarily. I don't know if Megan, your hand went up. Or
I was scratching because there's a mosquito in my office.
That is excellent.
Classic classroom situation. You have a question there? Oh no, it's just a question.
Sorry, I just thought I was like shutting you out somehow and just talking over your inquiry and felt terrible.
No. Well, let's give you Russ a little break. Ben, now that we're in a good mood, why don't you bum us out a little bit?
So I have two pieces of very sad news to share, but we'll end on a happy note here. But we've lost one. Actually, we've two PAS Hall of Fame members, one of which has passed away, and the other which has been put into hospice care. The first one I wanted to mention is Ellie Minette, who there was a New York Times article about this. He died of kidney failure at the age of 90. In Morgantown, West Virginia, which was his sort of adopted home. If you're not familiar, Ellie Minette is considered the father of the modern steel drum. And there's an excellent, it's about 9 minute long video on YouTube from the Smithsonian Folklife Institute, I guess, called Ellie Minette, Father of the Modern Steel Drum, if you're interested in looking that up. But just a quick little bio. He was born in Sanssouci, Trinidad on November 5th, 1927. At the age of 11, he joined his first band, and in 1940, he formed the Invaders Steel Orchestra with two of his brothers and other musicians in the area. Minette said that percussion instruments had been banned by colonialists in Trinidad in the 1940s and 50s, and Minette helped bring bring percussion instruments in Trinidad out of that quote-unquote denigrated status by making the music more and more compelling. He was one of the first to develop a chromatic steel drum, and in 1951, Trinidad and Tobago sent him to Britain as part of the Trinidad All-Steel Percussion Orchestra. By 1959, that band actually had a contract with Columbia Records. In the 1960s, Mr. Minette traveled to the United States to help develop the Navy Steel Band, which brought steel band music to the American public. And in 1967, he made the transition permanent, moving to New York to work with Urban Youth and Music Programs. He was named, in 1999, he was named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts. In 2000, which was his first time to return to Trinidad since he left in 1967, he was awarded the Chaconia Medal from Trinidad and Tobago, which is the country's second highest decoration. And in 2003, he was inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame. If you're interested in a very sort of sweet eulogy, Andy Norell actually put on Facebook a little eulogy to his friend Ellie Minette, which I thought was beautiful. The next person I wanted to talk about was Vida Chenoweth, who we actually discussed in depth on episode 21 of At Percussion way back when with Excelsis Percussion Quartet. And her niece, Leanne Chenoweth Lawson, put on Facebook that Vida has been placed in hospice care and is expected to pass soon. Vida was inducted into the Oklahoma Hall of Fame in 1985 and the PAS Hall of Fame in 1994. And I just wanted to read two quotes from that little thing that Leanne Chenoweth Lawson put on Facebook. She said she always had her sense of humor as long as her mind was working. She was an amazing, strong little lady, 5'2", size 5 shoe, and so intelligent and strong. And then later on, she says, Aunt Vida went to live in New York City after college at Northwestern in Chicago. She had also studied marimba in Guatemala and music in Paris. She eventually had an agent and performed with numerous orchestras from New York and Philadelphia to South America. Her last job was teaching ethnomusicology and marimba at Wheaton College half the year and University of New Zealand at Auckland half the year. We laughed about how she had fallen winter all year. She had many talents, and I included a painting on this post that she did of her beloved Maltese, Sammy. And Vita Chinwith, from what I understand, was just a very sort of vigorous, passionate person. There's some kind of funny photographs of her like in a bikini, which was considered risque back in the 19, whatever it was. And then the last piece of news on a happier note was Leonard Bernstein just celebrated his 100th birthday. Of course, he's no longer with us, but we celebrated his 100th birthday. And there was actually a Google Doodle to celebrate, which I thought was kind of cool. It had some music from West Side Story on it. Bernstein was born August 25th, 1918. So August 25th, 2018 was his 100th year. We discussed Leonard Bernstein a little bit on episode 63 with Tony Cerrone and episode 147 with Norm Weinberg. And I was trying to find it, but we have a contemporary music, quote-unquote, guest on today. And there was actually a while back, I remember reading a thing by Paul Lansky, and it was driving me crazy because I couldn't find it. But Paul Lansky talks about the New York Philharmonic actually had, under Bernstein, a contemporary music series. And Paul Lansky talked about, I think it was when he was studying with Milton Babbitt, all of Milton Babbitt's students went with their scores and watched a New York Philharmonic rehearsal. And he said it was just amazing to watch Leonard Bernstein on stage with his teacher's score. And I read like a New York Times article, and it talked about how Leonard Bernstein was not afraid to program contemporary music that he thought had legitimacy, but didn't necessarily speak to his personal tastes. And was very invested in getting everything that the composer wanted out of the score. So I thought that was maybe a happier way to wrap up the eulogy, so to speak, here.
Wow, thanks, Ben. Yeah, sorry to hear the news. And speaking of the New York Times, I have a Vita Chinwith record sitting here on my lap. And from the New York Times review on the cover, it says, expert virtuoso, her rhythm superb, her confidence epical, New York Times. So that's record by Vita Chinwith, which is just, of course, my predecessor, Bill Rice. He left a lot of really cool records here, and that was one of them. So thanks so much, Bill.
Yeah, I've never actually heard her play. I've heard a lot about her playing, but I found on YouTube there's a recording of her playing the Bach, was it E major violin partita, that one that everyone plays, and yeah, just nails it.
Yeah, I was judging the PAS Marimba finals once, and this lady came in, sat down next to me, and I thought she was just gonna get, you know, a close seat, and I started having a nice conversation with her, thinking I might have to tell her, oh, this is actually the judge's row, but it didn't get that far. And she said, oh, my name's Vita Chinwith. So I had this like really great sort of like conversation you'd have in the park with someone when you're just sharing a bench kind of conversation with her. And it was just really, I don't know, I feel lucky I got to chat with her even for just, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah, and for anyone that's not familiar with Vita Chinwith, if you want to know the one of the largest pieces of significance with her, other than her just being a complete badass player, she was the link between Claire Ohlmeyer and Lee Howard Stevens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a big deal, obviously.
Yeah, right. So, if people out there that, if marimba is your thing, yeah, she is a big reason why marimba is a thing at all, for sure. Thanks a lot, Ben. Well, you guys, I do have a sound for you if no one else has anything more on these guys. Cool. So, yeah, so the sound today I have for you is not a sound at all, which is really deep and compelling if you think about that. I do have a hint for you. You've probably seen this type of thing floating around. I think it was, it's one of those like cool internet tricks. So it is a video, and I just sent it in the chat. So those of you who are just listening, I will insert the video, but don't crash your car to look at the video. It's not quite that interesting. But if you guys can take just a second or two and watch this. Has anybody...
Six white balls floating as like floating by... low frequency oscillators or something.
I'm close, trying to read about it. Yeah, 28
kilohertz. Super high.
Yeah, super high frequencies. So yeah, of course, if those of you who couldn't see and are just listening, what we had there was these little floating, and it happens to be a styrofoam particle what this guy is putting, and it seems to be just like magically floating in the air. And the person on the video there can even put them in an ordering, almost like a little ladder, and they're shaking very small they're shaking very rapidly, a very small amount of motion. And what this is something called acoustic or ultrasonic levitation. So what's happening is that the object is being suspended in a very high frequency sound wave. So of course the object's really light. That's the only way it can actually, you know, beat the force of gravity. But what you've got there is a very, very high frequency speaker, too high for us to hear, hence the word ultrasonic. And it's emitting a frequency, and that's hitting a reflector, and the reflector is bouncing the sound wave back, and it's making what's called a standing wave. So if you can imagine a wavelength, right, there's these crests and dips, it goes up and down, and a standing wave is the exact wave shape, but inverted on top of itself. So every time you have a crest, you also have a dip, and it kind of makes these long strands of figure eights, or if you want to imagine a chain. So there's these like loops of waves back and forth. And what that does is it creates points of high and low pressure. So when the waves are far apart, there's low pressure. And when they're close together, there's high pressure. The high pressure pushes the particles apart, or in this case, the little pieces of styrofoam, and they fall into a low pressure area, and they're just sitting there being squeezed, and they seem to float. So that's the basic part of it. And then I have one more to show you that's a little more complex. So here's one more.
Whoa.
So as you can see, they've got it happening in two dimensions now, so they can go forward and backward and, oh, sorry, three dimensions. They can go up and down also. So this is, of course, array of speakers, one just basically a square of speakers and reflectors, and they can time the movement with computers and time the frequencies so that the reflection rate and the rate of the sound wave, the ultrasonic sound, manipulate in just such a perfect ratio that they can actually move materials around. So it's kind of just a cool lab trick, cool, you know, physics teacher experiment, but they're starting to say there may be some practical uses, one of them being moving or suspending hazardous waste, like chemicals that you wouldn't want to touch, or they would be so corrosive that you wouldn't want to put them in any container. They're saying, well, maybe you could actually, it might be more practical to suspend them with sound. So they're trying to scale this up to, it can do much heavier objects. And a more immediate practical use is something called acoustic tweezers. And there's a great article, just the Wikipedia article I thought was amazing. There was just an extensive amount of things there. And what this does is it can remove particles from the human body without going inside of your body. So if you can imagine blood flow, say, coming down, and you have a speaker outside of the blood flow, and it's shooting these acoustic tweezers into the, which is just a sound wave, it's shooting a sound wave through the bloodstream, it can remove harmful substances so that bad blood can get washed, as they say. It can move down, have a bad particle removed from it, and then it can carry on. So this avoids a process called blood washing, which is like after surgery, your blood can have these bad effects on it, and because your body reacts to the invasive procedure, and then they have to do something called wash your blood, and this is a way to do it with like on the spot right there and then. So I'm not sure. I just didn't get far enough to see if that's actually something they're implementing right now, but they do know it works. So that's your sound for the week. It's called ultrasonic or acoustic levitation. And actually, some scientists have a problem with it being called levitation because you're not actually levitating anything, you're suspending it. So blah, 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 like we care. But that's something they said. That is not levitating, that is suspending. So I tried to figure out, oh yeah, well, why don't they just call it acoustic suspension then? And it turns out there's something else called acoustic suspension that has to do with speakers and the build quality of speakers and stuff. So that might be why, but I don't know.
Well, for one, that doesn't sound nearly as cool as levitation, but
levitation sounds like magic.
Yeah. But I wanted to add a little something that I learned recently. I was reading an article about apparently gravity is actually very difficult to measure. And I was reading about it, and gravity is actually an extremely weak force. And to all of us, it's like, really? No, but gravity is what holds literally everything down in the entire world. But it did point, this article pointed out, like, you can defy gravity, or you can at least overcome gravity with, like, the world's smallest magnet and pick something up. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting, because gravity always seems like such a big force, but it's really, you know, comparatively to pushing something with your hand, very weak.
Ben, I thought of you on this because I wanted to ask you, what common Star Trek tool does this remind you of?
Acoustic suspension. I can't remember the name, but I know what you're talking about.
Come on, farmers.
It's been a while. I know it's the tracker beam.
Tractor beam.
Yeah. There we go. Beam. Took me a second.
Yeah, that's right. It moves objects. Let's get Ross talking again with our other Facebook question. Our friend Will Marinelli, thanks for writing in, Will. You always have such good questions. He asks, what has been the most unusual instrument or sound effect that you've had to use with ice?
That's a pretty good question. I saw it on Facebook and I was racking my brain a little bit to try and come up with the most peculiar sound, because it seems like every week is a different sonic adventure with the composers we're working with. Martin Hindle wrote a piece for us where I had to fire a starter pistol several times, but that's not new to those who've played the Ligeti percussion quartet. No, is it Ligeti? Or maybe it's Bad Führer's percussion quartet, I think, has a starter pistol in it as well. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the most uncomfortable piece of equipment to play. It's an odd one because you have to wear headphones or, you know, like the over-ear lawn mowing ear muffs to protect your ears. And in this particular piece, I had to fire at very specific rhythms, like actually, you know, not just on downbeats or whatever, but quite intricate rhythmic stuff, and it doesn't respond perfectly every time. So that was an adventure, and it's not an instrument you want to practice very much because you waste the ammunition or
you waste ammo.
You waste the pellets or whatever. I don't know what happens. There's just the blanks, really. There's nothing fires out the end, luckily. And so that was a strange one, but I think a lot of the composers we're working with now are interested in phenomena that I'm super fascinated by as well, which is basically the technique of combining two instruments in to create a filtration. So we've all seen this, like the oldest example that we readily play on is putting a cymbal on a timpano and glissing the pedal while rolling on it so that the sound of the cymbal is filtered through the timpani. And I think that spirit of that kind of combination of filtration is really, really common. And so recently we've been playing around a lot with tensioning aircraft cable or wire rope across frame drums with a cello bridge, kind of like the way a banjo works, and then bowing that aircraft cable and changing the head tension with pressure and being able to create these bowed drums. We call them string drums, but that's a little bit confusing compared to a lion's roar or something like that. As Megan knows from my class at Interlock, and I was sort of joking that I rarely am asked to hit or strike instruments as often as bow them, rub them, whatever, use some sort of friction to make the thing sound, to excite the frequencies that are trapped within it. So there's a bunch of categories of that kind of inventiveness that composers are using these days when they have the always fun experience of a one-on-one collaborative conversation with a percussionist. And that's something that we do on a weekly basis here, is invite percussionists over to the studio and mess around with different sounds. And it's an actual life realization of the liquid drum joke. Hey, what does this sound like? And what does it sound like when you put a potato on a vibraphone? Well, I would be lying if I said that we hadn't tried that. So
wait, that's just a joke?
Yeah, I thought it wasn't a joke, and then someone let me in on the sarcasm behind it. Now I'm not sure.
I guess I have a follow-up question. One contemporary music story that I always love to tell is that one time I had to play a bull roar. If anyone's not familiar, it's basically a little plank on a piece of string that you spin around your head, which is fine, but I was playing it in a relatively small setup that also contained chimes, which you can do the math. The Bullroarer was often making collisions with the chimes. So have you ever had anything impractical like that? Well, I shouldn't ask have you, but what have you had that's impractical like that that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had a lot of Bullroarer nightmares. And I want to just say that there is another instrument that makes almost the same sound that's totally safe. It's called a wind wand, and you can get it from Lark in the Morning or other places like that. They're really
Bill Mersch owned one of those that I borrowed, and that made it a lot better, but still not great.
it's still there's still some risk, but and it doesn't make exactly the same sound. So if you're really looking for a piece of wood on a string that you fling around at the risk of impaling everybody in the audience, then you still want to use the Bullroarer. But the wind wand is a pretty good and easily controlled dynamic envelopes, and you can change the pitch, and that's a kind of fun substitute. I find that we don't have a rule, but we have a guideline when commissioning pieces that people avoid some of the largest instruments. We tend not to include timpani and 5-octave marimba in the ensemble commissions because the logistics of it sort of created an impossibility. So, but beyond that, we welcome all the composers' ideas, and a lot have been super inventive in the solution of how to find low frequencies of percussion from small sizes and small volumes. One thing I find super fascinating is are the insides of grandfather clocks. There's not the clock coils that Cage requests and the piano concerto and things like that, but clock rods. There are these like long, super dense metal rods that have a weighted base. And when you play them, when the bass is on a resonator, like a bass drum or a cajon or something, they're super loud and low frequency from a very small size. I've seen a lot of people being super inventive with that type of sympathetic resonator as a way of getting more sound out of a small size. And we just did a piece, and we've been doing a piece for a couple of years actually, by an amazing composer who has a great percussion solo named Ashley Fury. She wrote this opera called The Force of Things. It's for five instrumentalists and two vocalists. And it requires an 80-foot long cello string, which we make out of aircraft cable. And it's suspended over a styrofoam bridge that's 4.5 feet tall. So in order to play the piece, you need a space with at least an 80-foot length. So that's perhaps the most impractical instrument because it requires that length to even sound the right frequencies. And maybe I'll send you all some videos of what that sounds like. It's a pretty wild resulting sound.
You just like open the door, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So in this case, it had to extend into the audience, which is very cool anyway. The piece definitely requires a lot of very, very strange or unorthodox uses of large and small scale instruments.
Cool. And she has a percussion solo, you said.
Yeah. Yeah, so she and I worked together on a piece called Shiverlung 2. It's a part of a series. Shiverlung 1 is for septet, and Shiverlung 2 is for percussion solo. And it's two subwoofer speakers out of their case. So it's just two raw 15-inch subwoofer cones, and you set them on their magnets so that they face upward, sort of like a turtle on its back. And the speaker cones vibrate at 11 hertz, which is just inaudible in terms of its frequency, but it makes an audible oscillation of a rhythm, which is like second, 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 or something like that. And then you set rattling things inside the speakers over a progression that she's designed. And it's really, really nice piece. I've recorded it. It should come out next summer, but there's, in the meantime, I think there's some pirate videos out there on the YouTubes for people to check out.
Cool.
And you can always write her. She's an awesome composer and great to chat with. You can write her directly about getting the score and the technical instructions for that. It's a pretty great piece.
Cool.
Wow, neat. If you guys are ever interested, I almost was going to include this in my little sound segment, but look up the definition of decibel. There's way more to it than I thought. Like, we measure sound in bells, but it's multiplied by 10, as in decibel. And it's just way more complex, the measuring system for sound, because like 2 decibels, like you have, sorry, I'm saying this wrong. For us to perceive sound twice as loud, it has to be more than exceed twice as many decibels. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think decibels are measured logarithmically, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's on this logarithmic scale. Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, are you guys ready for your quiz?
Ready.
Ross, take points for these guys. They have too many points. I'm tired of adding up the points. So, okay. Yep, if you know it, just yell it out. Okay. This person might be the most famous person we've ever mentioned on the podcast. She, along with composer George Antheil, created and patented a torpedo guidance technology called frequency hopping. I see you putting me there, but it's not done. Hang on. She created and patented a torpedo guidance technology called frequency hopping. Her name is Hedy Lamarr, but your question is, how did the proposed guidance system work?
Like a player piano.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So her idea was that, well, back up a little bit. The problem with guiding a torpedo to its target is that you can jam the signal. So if the signal is at a number, say, I don't know, 60, all the enemy has to do is guess the right frequency and it's gone. And all they would have to do is keep trying them so it can be easily jammed. But her idea was that, well, what if the frequency was always hopping? It was changing from one number to the next. But the problem is the torpedo and the transmitter would have to be following that same sequence, and technology just wasn't at that point yet. But with a piano roll, you could have one in the torpedo, one in the transmitter, and they could stay in sync. They could be started at the same time, follow the same number sequence, and the two could be switching transmissions in perfect unison. Okay, moving on. Okay, there's a two-part answer to this one. I need the profession, guess name, and the title of the piece. So in a quote, poorly edited PAS article, it was written in error that this marimba solo was premiered with only 5 of its 7 movements. What was the person and the piece?
When you say person, you mean the player or the
composer? Yeah, sorry, the player, that's right.
It was Bill Mersch playing Druckmann's Reflections on the Nature of Water.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, in some PAS article, Ben corrected a previous report that said he only did he only did 5 of the 7 movements, but he actually did all 7 movements.
All 6 movements. There's only 6 movements, and for a while after that, apparently, like, Mersch would get, like, emails like, where's the 7th movement? There isn't one. There's only 6 movements.
Oh, sorry. Right. Yes, thank you.
I should get extra points because I corrected you.
Nice. That's fine. That's going to happen over and over. Yeah, so that was Ben way back on episode 6. Okay, last question. Another false report story. This microphone was falsely reported as, quote, the president's new microphone, giving him an extra, quote, 20 decibel boost in volume, making him the loudest president ever. What was that microphone?
The SM57.
Yeah, that's right. The Shure SM57. I just put that question in because I saw Ross is using an SM57. Yeah, so there was this news report about Donald Trump's new microphone saying, oh, yeah, he's got this new presidential microphone. He wants to be louder than any other president. And this microphone gives you a 20 decibel boost. It's totally BS. It's not true at all. The SM57 set of 2, which is typical, has been in practice and has been standard equipment with the White House since 1967, starting with Lyndon Johnson. You can find every president up to Donald Trump using SM57. So it's just a total,
fake news.
It sounds like
actual fake news, yeah.
You know, a reflection of kind of how the presidency is going, that he was like, no, I need to be louder. It's not loud enough. And then someone was like, just give him this one and tell him it's louder.
Just
tell him it's
20 decibels louder. I have the loudest fine.
Oh, it sounds totally believable considering just what's up. And I heard that and I thought, oh, yeah, okay, what's the microphone? That's interesting. So I looked up pictures and I didn't recognize the mic with its big windscreen. Like Ross is holding his right now. It has no windscreen. Hers right there has a small windscreen. And what Donald Trump had was the big gray windscreen, which covers so much of the microphone. So I thought, oh, yeah, what the heck is that thing? But, yeah, dig around a little bit. Dude, it's SM57. It's just
Dude, I bet that's what they did. I bet they just put the windscreen on it and they were like, it's different.
See? It's big.
New microphone. Bigger microphone. It's like when your conductor's like, yeah, do you have different mallets? And you're like, yeah, I do. And you just put them down and then grab the same ones. And they were like, that's so much better. You're like, yeah, I know. It's way better. Like,
I know. Yeah, it's a bigger mouth. Yeah. Well, you guys, thanks so much. This was fun. Ross Carr, so great to meet you.
Nice to meet you all, too. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Okay, everyone, we will catch you next time. Take it easy.
Sounds good.